So how do you actualize the juice? How do you get the power to live? The power to change your own life? The power to become different? The power to free you from resentment and overwhelming, paralyzing fear? The power to come out and play and be free? And consequently, the power not to be placed in a position of neutrality from alcohol, safe and protected. The problem that I face, and most of us face, is a problem of too much of me. When I was brand new, I just started praying to God, but I don't really believe in God yet. I had to pray for consistently for a period of time, and then observe what was happening in my life till I eventually developed some kind of faith. And it was a process. But I'm new, and I'm just starting to pray, and I'm going to meetings, and I have a sponsor, and I'm doing what my sponsor asked me to do. And I go to this meeting one day, and a guy corners me, this guy named Joe, and he's an old timer in AA. And Joe says to me, he says, "I heard what you shared in the meeting." And he said, "Kid, you need to take step three." And I, they have the 12 steps on the wall of the meeting hall. And I read step three. And we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And I not only don't understand God, I'm not even sure if I believe in God yet. I mean, I don't have a God. I don't have none of that. And I told Joe that. I said, "Joe, I can't take step three. I don't really believe in God." And Joe said, "You don't have to believe in God to take step three." And I said, "Well, it's kind of what it says." And he said, no, kiss. He says, "Listen, kid, trust me. If you'll turn your will and your life over to this chair," and he points to a chair in the Alano Club, he says, "I guarantee you an instant miracle." So I thought, what the hell? Okay, I turn my will and my life over to the chair. What's the miracle? And he says, "Oh, the miracle would be your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot." And I didn't get mad. I guess I was surrendered enough and demoralized enough that I just thought, yeah, that'd be right. Because I got it. I knew that I'd been destroying myself. And if you're anything like me, whoever's watched you, and the worst decisions you will make are sober. Whoever has watched you the last year or so would easily come to the, if you're running your life on self-will, drunk or sober, and people are observing you, it's easy to come to the conclusion whoever's making decisions for this person is out to destroy them. And yet, from inside me, it never looks that way because of my ability to justify and rationalize it. I've had some great mentors over the years. And there was a guy named Dale who was an old-timer when I got sober, and he eventually died of cancer, but he was a great member of AA. And Dale cornered me one time after a meeting, and he says, "Listen," and he liked me. He was kind of a gruff old guy, but he really liked me because I did a lot of service, and he really respected that. And he came up to me, he says, "Listen, kid, I'm going to tell you some stuff. If you'll buy this, it's going to save you a lot of pain and a lot of grief." He says, "Kid, I want you to know that if you're explaining something, if you're defending something, if you're justifying something or rationalizing something, kid, I want you to know you're wrong. Because you never have to defend, explain, justify, or rationalize what's right." And he told me that. That's been 30-some years ago that he told me that, and I've never found an exception to that yet. It's the chattering. It's when I'm doing something that is out of line, that is against what I should really be doing, that I got to have the conversations have to start coming in my head to defend my position and explain it to myself. You never have to explain what's right, but you will always have to defend and justify and explain anything that's contrary to your very nature. And this thing we talk about really, that's God's will, is simply to align myself to be doing what I should have been doing all along, rather than being in conflict with life itself. On page 60, it starts this section on step three. And my sponsor, my first sponsor, was like a fanatic about this section of the book. I mean, he was not big on much else, but he was big on this. 60 through 63 had me read it over and over and over again. And I start, you know, I'd read it and I don't really get it. I mean, I don't see it. And I'm going to read some of it and see what, we'll talk a little bit about the things that handicap me. It says, our description, middle of the page, our description of the alcoholic, which we touched on a little bit, page 20 and 21, the chapter more about alcoholism, the doctor's opinion, they could all be part and parcel of the descriptive, there's several descriptions of alcoholism. The chapter to the agnostic, which we just touched on a little bit, and our personal adventures, our experience, before and after. Before and after what? Before and after drinking? I don't think so. I don't think my experience at times after with just not drinking wasn't that good. I think it's before and after having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. On our personal adventures, before and after, make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that I was alcoholic and I could not manage my own life, period. No exceptions, no afterthoughts or caveats. It doesn't say anything. And I think a lot of us, I know I did, I think I unconsciously thought that my life was only unmanageable as a result of my drinking. That surely sober, going to meetings with a clear mind, I'll be able to manage my own life. I mean, why not? And I think a lot of us, I know this was my experience, I had to have that second and more than one, but at least that major second surrender where, you know, I get broken by my absolute failure controlling and enjoying my drinking, and it brings me to my knees, and I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm surrendered by the bottle, and then in abstinence, years into sobriety, going to a meeting every day, I'm surrendered by life itself. At my absolute failure to make things okay no matter how much effort I put into them. That I could not manage my own life, period. Not just, my life, truthfully, is more unmanageable sober because it's sober when I start having the problems with the emotions and all the crazy thoughts and the jobs and the relationships. And it's sober where my life is the most unmanageable because I don't have the benefit of anesthetic. Two, that probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. You didn't have to sell me on that. I had tried everything that came up on the radar. And three, that God could and would if he were sought. Well, I don't know. I don't think most of us know that till we seek him for a while. I think that is the proof is found in the actions. And then it says, being convinced of those three propositions, we were at step three. And what are those three propositions? Aren't they really the essence of step one and step two? In my experience with all the guys I sponsor who have difficulty with step three, they don't really have difficulty with step three. Their difficulty is in step one and step two. If you fully concede your innermost self and you get the ABCs, you get step one and two. Step three is automatic. In step three, it says we made a decision. Decision comes from a Latin word, scissore, meaning to cut. It's the same root word as the word scissors or the word incision when a surgeon will cut into a patient. When you make a decision, you have literally cut away the alternatives. And if you're alcoholic, which means you have a terminal illness, you're going to relapse yourself to death or maybe in abstinence blow your brains out. And you can't manage your own life. In other words, you can't fix yourself. You can't arrange your life enough to make you happy and okay sober. and no human power. You've done everything. You've gone to the doctors, the psychiatrists, the hospitals, the treatment centers. You changed jobs and relationships and towns and did everything that was possible. And no human power could relieve your alcoholism. Well, then there is either a power greater than you and all of that that's going to solve your problem, or you're screwed. You're basically, you're back to the other choice, going on to the bitter end, just trying to blot out the pain of your intolerable situation with relationships and sex and medications and anything you can get your hand on to blunt the emotions till you eventually die. So effectively, all the alternatives have been cut away. I am at step three. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go, even if you're like me and you're an atheist. It's not so much, I may not even believe in God, but I believe in the idiot that's been running my life. I believe I got to get away from him. And it's odd. I think that most of us move closer to God by moving away from ourselves. It's like everything we're going to talk about in the next couple pages that's designed to bring me to step three is not about God. It's about how messed up I am. Because if you're desperate enough and out of alternatives enough, you'll try God. I mean, where else are you going to go? So being convinced, and this is back to our innermost self, because the word convinced is a very strong word. This is not, can you kind of intellectually see? This is deep down in you. Being convinced, we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? Great question. I thought it meant maybe I should go to church. I thought maybe, well, it means I should pray. It's so much more than that. Well, the book says, okay, here's where we're going to start talking about it. The first requirement is that I be convinced. There's that convinced word again, deep down in me. Convinced that any life, or that my life in particular, run on self-will can hardly be a success. Is that true? On that basis, what basis? The basis of me running my life on self-will. On that basis, I am almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives are good. My motives are always good. And yet I'm always the guy that's having the internal conflict with life itself. I'm the guy having the arguments in my head with people that aren't in the room. I'm the guy that's in conflict with life itself. Each person, most people try to live by self-propulsion. Isn't that kind of, I love that. That's the picture in my mind that comes about when I think about that. It was almost as if I would get sober. And while I was in treatment, I was like a balloon that somebody's blowing up until it's blown up really well. And then I get out of treatment, it's like letting the balloon go. And so in the propulsion, I would just... And I'd run out of gas. It's time to drink. You know, when you get to the point, everything you've just crazily brought into your life and done it, and the shines wore off of all of it. Self-propulsion. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. And this is a beautiful analogy Bill creates. He says we're like an actor who wants to run the whole show. Now, it doesn't say, he's not the director. It's an actor. It's not the leading character. Matter of fact, it doesn't even say the guy has a speaking part. It's just, he's just one of the guys in the deal. Just one of the guys. But yet this guy who just has a little bit part in this play, he's trying to tell the other people what to do. He's trying to forever arrange the lights. You know, he's telling the spotlight guy, hey, you know, you should put the lights more on me, maybe. That's what I would say. I mean, you know, I wouldn't be telling him to put them more on you. I mean, why would you do that when you know where the real center of the universe is? My mother one time told me I wasn't the center of the universe. I was just a little kid. And I placated her. Yeah, Mom. But then I looked around and I turned around in a full circle and I thought, but I am. We're trying forever to arrange the lights, the ballet, want the dancers dance more around me, the dance, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in my own way. If only my arrangements would stay put, if only people would do as I wished. Oh my God, this show would be great, wouldn't it? It'd be great. Everybody, including myself, of course, would be pleased and life would be wonderful. Well, I'm reading this. My sponsor's got me reading this part of the book over and over again, and it's written in the third person. Now, I tell the guys I sponsor to read it in the first person, to change it to I instead of we, because I'd read it, and it's written in the third person, and I thought they were talking about some kind of people out here somewhere. And I couldn't see that it was me. I couldn't see that I was the actor trying to run the whole show. Now, I could go to AA meetings and see that there were people in AA doing that. I could go to the business meetings of my home group and see there was a lot of people trying to run the whole show and tell people what to do there. There's people at work doing that. But I legitimately can't see that it's me. I can't see it. And isn't it odd? I could be doing the exact same controlling, manipulative actions as these people are doing, where I can see obviously that they're trying to run the show. Yet when I'm doing it, it doesn't look to me like I'm running the show, because this is the right way. I'm not running the show. I'm just trying to make things nice here for everybody. I mean, because I'm that kind of, I'm always thinking of others. Just trying to make things, it'd be better for everybody. Everybody, including myself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. Don't you see? This is better for you too. It's good. Good. And I can't see it. I can't see that I'm running the show because I think I'm right. And I had one of those days that often we have. Just, do you ever have one of those days you just wake up with a little angst? You just wake up like on edge, sort of. You don't know why. You just wake up and you just have that feeling like there's some crap going to happen today. And you got to watch for it. You got to watch. And if you watch for it, it's odd how you find it. And I went to work with just kind of a little edge, a little so uptight, little angst, and got to work. And we had this, I'm working as a cashier in this store, and we got a whole truckload of merchandise in that all had to be priced and put on the shelves. Well, I'm over there busting my ass, put price in this stuff and put it up on the shelf. The other two guys are just, they're sitting behind, standing behind the register drinking coffee and telling jokes and stuff. And I'm just glaring at them, putting up that stuff, you know. And the customers are coming in, and they're coming over and interrupting me as I'm working. These customers, they all want help. They want attention. I get crapped. I'm nice. Price this stuff up. I'm like there's a spring in the pit of my stomach, and it's just getting tighter and tighter and tighter. The boss comes through, he hangs out with the two idiots that are doing nothing, and doesn't even notice what I'm doing over here. Doesn't even appreciate that they're using me. I know it. Pissed, getting angst up. At the end of the day, I'm just uptight. I get off work, and I'm kind of in a hurry because I'm the secretary of this rush hour group, and I got to stop and get some styrofoam cups for the meeting. And I'm meeting a new guy there, and I don't want the new guy to get there before me, because they'll never sit in the right place. And I got to get there before him, and I'm kind of on this mission from God, you know, to get there before the new guy, and get everything set up, and I'd stop at the grocery store, and I'd get in that 12 items or less express line with the styrofoam cups, and I'm in line, and I'm behind a woman that's got 15 items. I've counted them twice. What I really wanted to do, I wanted to go back to the office, and I wanted to bring the manager. I wanted to bring him right here. I wanted to make him count the 15 items underneath the 12 items or less line so he could see the travesty that was going on in his store. But it had slowed me down, and I'm in a hurry, so I just tighten that spring up a little bit more. I get out in traffic. Now I'm in a hurry. I'm afraid that new guy's going to beat me there. Now I'm angst up pretty good. I get in this heavy traffic behind this woman, and there's a big gap between her and the cars in front of her because she's going 5 miles an hour below the speed limit. And I feel like my head's going to blow up, and she must be deaf because I'm hitting the horn. She didn't even hear it. There's one point in there I thought this insane thought. Thank God I just think insane things and don't do them all the time. The thought was, I should floor it. I'll push us both into oncoming traffic. We'd be killed, but she'd see. But I don't do nothing. I just angst up a little more. I get to the meeting, and the guy's there. He beat me. The new guy beat me there. And you know where he's sitting? He's sitting in the back of the room. I said, get up here. Sit up here. Right up. Right in the front. Right in the front. Got him sitting right in the front. Laid out all the literature. I mean, I can lay out some literature, too. I'm telling you. I waited patiently for the perfect two people to chair this meeting. It was one of those meetings where they had a chairman and a co-chairman. The chairman took the first half of the meeting, and the co-chairman took the second half. And I wanted to get the right two guys that are going to lay the message of Alcoholics Anonymous out for my new guy. And told the one guy, I said, we got a new guy here. We're not going to read chapter 5. We're going to read chapter 3. And he said, yeah, coach, cool. And it's all in place. It's going to be good. I can picture this new guy getting his year mentioning my name. They started the meeting off. They read chapter 3. The chairman says, anybody have anything they want to kick us off with? And some guy starts talking about shooting heroin. Well, he's not even done talking. Another guy jumps in, and some old guy, and cuts him off, says, you can't talk about that here. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, somebody else jumps in and tells that guy, he can talk about whatever he wants to talk about here. And it's like the meeting from hell. I mean, it's like, and all, the whole fantasy of the new guy getting the chip and mentioning my name is just like, just dissipating like smoke in the wind. And now I'm pissed. I'm the only one here that gets it. I'm the only one here. All these other people are assholes. They don't know what they're doing. And I'll tell you, I'm fed up. I'm tired about being the only one that cares. And I'm going to quit Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to quit these stupid people. And I go home, and I've been conditioned like Pavlov's dog to call my sponsor before I go to call my sponsor. And he says, well, read page 60 through 63. And I get to the bottom of page 60, and it says, we're like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, the rest of the players, the other employees, the customers, the people in the grocery store, the people in traffic, the people sharing in the meeting in his own way. If only my arrangements would stay put, if only people would do as I wish, the show would be great. Everybody, including myself, would be pleased. And it was like a veil lifted, and I just sat there and I thought, oh my God, that's me. That's exactly what I've been doing all day long. Now, it's amazing to me that I could go through life being that guy, causing myself problems, quitting jobs, alienating myself from people, ruining relationships, being that guy and never know it. And I never, until that moment, I never even peeped it. And not because I'm not a dumb guy. It's just the greatest trick the ego ever does is to convince us it doesn't exist. It hides behind a smokescreen of justification and chatter, the way it talks to me in my head. I'm not running the show. I'm, this is going to be good for everybody. Do you ever notice, when you get resentments, do you ever try? I have this thing inside me. I don't want to just get a resentment just because the person hurt my feelings. I have to take it to a global level. I'll resent somebody in AA because they're doing something's out of line, and I'll take it in my mind to the level where they're going to destroy Alcoholics Anonymous. Where it's like now it's a crusade. I mean, I got to make it global. The amazing ability to justify stuff is amazing in the alcoholic mind. The book says, in trying to make these arrangements, our actor may be sometimes quite virtuous. In this desperate need to arrange life so I'll be better, in this desperate attempt to play God, I may be quite seemingly virtuous. I may do it in a manner that's kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. I can do it all that way. But if that doesn't work, I can be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. Don't screw with me here. This is important. This is important. You don't see it, but this is, you don't get it. You're stupid. You're stupid. You don't get it. This is important. And I always try the first approach. I always try the kind, considerate, patient, generous. And to get my way, I'll try a little sugar. Little sugar, get my way. Because if you get your way being kind, patient, considerate, oh my God, you got your way and you kind of looked almost humble doing it. That's a hat trick. That's beautiful. That's like a win-win. I got my way and I looked good getting it. Wow. Does it get any better than that? But don't screw with me. Because I'll go and I'll talk crap about you behind your back until I'll get everybody on the same page and they'll be against you because you're against me. I'll go out of my way to turn people against you. Because isn't it all about me and this obsessiveness for me to get what I believe secretly is going to make me different and me happy and me better? So what the book says, what usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. And it's not like I ain't trying. I begin to think life doesn't treat me right. I decide to exert myself more. When all else fails, get a hammer. It's the only tool in my toolkit prior to Alcoholics Anonymous. I become on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be, whatever will work because I just need to get my way. Still, the play does not suit me. Admitting I may be somewhat kind of at fault, I am sure other people are more to blame. As a matter of fact, if you ever hear a person with untreated alcoholism say, that I might be wrong, it's only because they're absolutely sure they're not. And they're just trying to look humble. I am sure that if you would, life would be great. I'm convinced of it. Why is that? The book says he becomes angry, indignant, and self-pitying. What is my basic trouble? That is a brilliant question. I'd never stop to ask myself. I think my trouble's you. What is my basic trouble? And then here's the third delusion that the book talks about. The first two delusions keep me from staying sober. And this one will keep me in a state of emotional angst and depression and unhappiness for decades. Sober until I can't take it anymore. And then what? I drink again, get on medication, or blow my brains out, or surrender and do this. Am I not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Am I not a victim of the delusion that I can rest with a W like in wrestle, rest, satisfaction, and happiness out of this world if I only manage well? That delusion in some of us runs deep into our consciousness. The idea that if I just get all my ducks lined up in a row, if I got everybody kind of looking the right way at life, if I got the right people loving me the right way, not like those other people who screwed it up, if I got the right job, the right house, the right prestige, the right notoriety, surely, surely then I will have wrested satisfaction and happiness out of this world through all this management and effort on my part. The problem with that, and the reason that that's a delusion, if we could be objective about ourselves and we could step back from ourselves as a demographic and looked at ourselves in almost a scientific view, I don't think that you could find a demographic on the planet of people that have ever spent more money, more time, more effort, or obsessive energy on trying to make themselves satisfied and happy as we have. And the end result is I'm saying to someone, would you please sponsor me? Absolute failure. Let me tell you something. If I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world, I'd have done it. And I'm not talking about, some of you are thinking, well, the drinking got in the way. The best way to understand the second half of step one is to manage your own life for about 5 years without drinking. If you don't go insane and you don't ruin your life, you will come to that second collapse that involves the second half of step one. I came to it incrementally, but I came to it at great depth when I was a little over 4 years sober. When I was, by the time I was 4 years sober, I'd never worked the steps out of the book. And here's the dangerous part. I thought I had. I did two inventories. The first one was the common inventory of its time, where you just write about 30 or 40 pages of all your secrets and everything you're ashamed of, and you dump it on somebody. I did that, and I got to tell you, nothing changed. I did a second one where I didn't know what else to do, and I answered the 30-some questions in the chapter 4 in the book 12 Steps and 12 Traditions and wrote about a page on each of the 7 deadly sins. And I tell you, nothing changed. And then at 4 years sober, I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism. I'm going to 15 meetings a week. I'm a DCM. I'm on 2 convention committees. I got 2 hospital and institution commitments every week. I'm sponsoring guys. I have a commitment at my home group. I mean, you couldn't get any more involved in activity in Alcoholics Anonymous than I was, and I'm dying here. I can't outrun myself anymore. And I'm at that place where the Chuck Chamberlain talks about, where you get to a place where you can no longer put anything between you and you, and there you are. And I can't outrun myself anymore. And thank God, I'd been to a Joe and Charlie weekend. And one of the things that aggravated me about that weekend is when they were talking about step 4, they were saying things, and I thought, and I'd sit there and I'd go, oh, I didn't do that. Oh, that's not what I did. And I started defending myself. Well, what I did was actually better than that. I mean, I did that. But I knew inside me that I hadn't really done it. I knew it. And one of the hardest things to do is when you have the kind of ego I have, even though you're dying and you're fighting depression. And by the time I was 4 years sober, I'd already been through 9 jobs in 4 years. That speaks volumes of untreated alcoholism, because I'm always the guy that's leaving. I'm the guy who's always alone. And I can't run anymore. And I knew it. I knew I hadn't really done Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a guy that I sponsored who, right about this time, he asked me, he said, would you help me do a fourth step? And I'd just been through the Joe and Charlie thing, and I sat down with him, and we went through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we did line by line, and just when it said, write something, list something, pray something, realize something, we just did everything it said. And I got to watch that guy change. And it was perfect, because right after that, it was going to be my turn. I helped a guy I sponsor that was sober, newer than I was, do this before I ever did it. And it was brilliant, because the Hindus have a saying that the student doesn't learn the lesson until he becomes the teacher. I learned how to do a four-step, helping this idiot learn how to do a four-step. I learned it in a way I couldn't have learned it if I was trying to figure it out for me. But it's odd when you're looking because you care about somebody else, you see it differently, don't you? And I learned how to do a four-step by helping a guy do a four-step. When I was about a year sober, I got down on my knees and the book says we thought well before taking the third step. I said, before saying this third step prayer, and I think I thought well, but the truth was I had no idea what I was doing. I'd read this part of the book dozens of times. I don't even think I understood the words really and what they meant to me personally. I don't think I got it. Isn't that odd that you could say a prayer over and over again and not really even understand it? And I got down on my knees and I said the third step prayer on page 63. And I'm going to read it. If you want to say it along with me, feel free. You don't have to. These are the formal terms of surrender. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Well, I didn't do what it said after that, which is we started once on this house cleaning. Not too long after that, I wrote the 30-some page, the almost 40 pages of crap. But the 10 months after I said the third step prayer were very painful. I tell you, there were times in that next 10 months where I thought I was going to have a nervous breakdown. It was horrible. Within no time at all after taking this prayer, saying this prayer on my knees with another member of AA, I lost my job. And this was the job that I thought I was going to have all my life. It was a career. And not only did I lose this job, and I'd lost jobs before, but this job was important to me. And I lost this job, and then I put out resumes, and I could not get a job anywhere in this venue. And I even stretched it out to sort of related fields. Could not. Every door was closed, every single door. Now I'm getting scared because I don't have any savings, really. And I'm a pretty much a paycheck-to-paycheck kind of guy, and now I don't have a job, and I can't get one. And I'm scared. Right after that, my roommate moves out. Now, I'm living in a two-bedroom apartment, which I'm only paying half the rent and half the utilities with a roommate and a job. Now I got no roommate and no job. I got homelessness coming at me. And I don't know if I can weather homeless sober. I got this girl I'd been dating, and she dumped me. Started dating somebody else. I started going through these emotional roller coasters that were just bizarre, I mean, very erratic, where I could just be sitting having a cup of coffee. Nobody said nothing to me. Nobody's done nothing. Nothing's happening. And all of a sudden, this ball of emotion would just rise up, and I just sit there, and I just start sobbing. And I don't even know why. And I felt like I was losing it. I felt like I'm having a nervous breakdown here. I got to tell you something. There's a thin line between nervous breakdown and surrender. They're almost identical. God's trying to move me into a collapse that will change my life. And I don't know what's going on. I went to my sponsor and I told him, I said, I can't, I'm getting worse. And he said, you know what he said to me? He says that crazy stuff. People say, he said, oh, you're right on course. For what? A train wreck? What are you talking about? Right on course. My life's falling apart. The wheels have come off. I'm dying here. I'm going to be living in an alley somewhere within 2 weeks. And she just smiles. Oh, you're going to be okay. What's making me so sick? I feel like I'm losing my mind. What's threatening my very abstinence? What's happening? No. Here's the problem. When I got down on my knees and I said to God, here I am, for you to build with me and to do with me as you will, God took that literal. And he started building with me and he started doing with me. And I was like an old burnout house that somebody's trying to rehab. You got to tear a lot of crap out in order to make room for new stuff. Here's the problem. The problem is God has not presented me the blueprints for my approval. He just starts building and doing, and he don't call me up. If he called me up, he had the decency to call me up and say, oh, hey, Bob, that job, that's a nowhere job for you. Guys don't have a hard time staying sober doing that. You don't want to stay there. He said, we're going to move you over here, Bob, and you're going to eventually learn this other business, and it's going to be very good for you, and you're going to build a big corporation over there, and you're going to make a lot of money, and you're going to be able to retire very young and be set for life. Would that be okay for you? He doesn't say that. He just takes the job. If he'd have said to me, oh, Bob, we got to get your roommate to move out because there's a guy from Florida moving to town, and you and Greg are going to be roommates for a couple of years, and you guys are going to do a lot of 12-step work together, and you're going to co-start another 12-step fellowship, and it's going to help a lot of people, and you're going to do a lot of service in the community, and it's going to take your program to a new level. Would that be okay for you, Bobby? He didn't say that. He just took the roommate. If he'd have said, that girl you're dating, she's going to be drunk within 6 months, Bob. You don't want to be emotionally tied into that. But he didn't say that. He just took her out of my life. And if you would have said, you know, you've had some emotions that have been pent up in you for years, and we got to cook them out of you. But he just started doing and building with me exactly what I asked him to do. And the problem is, I don't understand what's happening. If I knew, or if I really trusted God, I should have been cheering what was going on. I should have been just going, go, God, go. Because everything he's taking from me is to make room for more, for a better life. What's making me sick? It's my will. It's my judgment. It's me afraid I'm not going to get my way. And that's why in the third step, when we make the decision, it's will first. We make a decision to turn our will, to surrender my will. The word surrender comes from two Latin words, sur meaning above and render meaning to go back to. I'm giving back to above what I got. I'm giving myself back to God for him to build with me and do with me. And in other words, if you're really sincere about the decision in step three, you're really taking a position where you're going to, from now on, you're going to try to make your life none of your business. It's now God's business. Well, that makes people like me crazy. What do you mean it's not my business? Well, what do you do? If all you've ever worried about and thought about for decades is you, how can you stop that? You can't, can you? So I asked God to relieve me of this bondage of self. That I'm a hostage, I'm shackled to my own obsessive self-involvement, that my intention to carry out the decision in step three does not carry it out. There's a great line in this part of the book where it says that the self-centeredness, we must be rid of it, we must, or it kills us, and yet it says you can't wish it away any more than alcohol. The knowledge that I'm self-centered, the knowledge that I got to stop running the show does not make me stop running the show. Not even close. You know, I got down on my knees and I said that third step prayer at about a year sober, and the next 3 years were insane because I had never went through the rest of the work. On the bottom of page 60, it talks about what had happened to me in those 2.5 or 3 years. It says, next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. This is like immediately getting up off your knees after saying the third step prayer. Next, of which a personal house cleaning, which many of us never attempted, though our decision, step three, was a vital and a crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once, which in my case was 3 years, unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. I remember I started saying the third step prayer every morning. I'd get down on my knees and I'd say that prayer. And I'd get up off my knees, and a half hour later, I'm full of fear and I'm angst and I'm half-ass depressed because I can't carry it out. I get off my knees and I get in the car and I drive to work, and I'm having conversations in the car with people that I'm going to see later that day. I can't get off the deal of playing God. I can intend to, I can say the prayer, but I can't carry it out, because I'm blocked from carrying out the decision in step three. And I'm also blocked from God. You know, this thing that we talked about that the book says on page 55, where I'll find the great reality deep down within me, in the last analysis, only there that it'll be found. I'm blocked from God within me. There's no, I go in me. I don't get connected to God. All I get's a lot of me. I'm full of me. So I'm blocked from the God within me. I'm blocked from carrying out the decision in step three. And I'm blocked from other people. I'm blocked from community. You know, by the time I was 4 years sober, I was a self-righteous, judgmental guy. I took everybody's inventory in AA. You know, I don't say it because I don't want to look bad. But in my mind, I'm judging everybody. I'm picking everybody apart. I'm a gossip. I'm talking crap behind people's back, trying to grandize myself and make myself look better than them. I've gone through 9 jobs. A guy, one of the AA, after an AA meeting, came up to me, and I was so self-righteous when I'd share, I'm a table pounder, and I'm all that. You know, I'm a serious guy, serious. He says to me, he says, did you have your sense of humor surgically removed? Well, one of the symptoms of self-obsession is seriousness. It's an absolute inability to laugh at yourself or even get the joke. I mean, if I could have seen me the way I could see me now, or if I could have seen me the way you guys had seen me, the old timers were always picking on me, laughing at me, like picking at my seriousness, you know, because they could see me and they got the joke. I didn't get the joke. And, you know, the word humility and the word humor come from the same word, humus, meaning earth. I am never more humble than when I'm laughing at myself and not taking myself seriously. I'm never more self-obsessed than when I am just all over me and everything's serious and heavy and a big deal. I remember when I would sink into depressions, which is like maximized self-centeredness, where I just get so much of me right here that I smother myself with myself. See, I can't carry out the decision in step three. So I start on this process at a little over 4 years sober. I rolled up my sleeves, and I was at a point where I don't want to defend anything anymore. I don't want to be right about anything anymore. I just want to be free. I knew that I couldn't continue like I was. Now there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous who have been able to live for decades with untreated alcoholism and emotional angst and depression and all that stuff. And I'll tell you, I look at some of those guys and they're tough people. I mean, they are tough. They're like the John Waynes of alcoholism. I'm the Barney Fife or Pee Wee Herman of alcoholism. You know, I can't hold up to those day in and day out, my emotions putting the screws to me. I can't cave. I can't hold like some people. I'm not a John Wayne here. I'm a more pathetic version. And so I made it to 4 years, and I made it to 4 years by going to a ton of meetings and a lot of service and a lot of 12-step work, a lot of committees, a lot of H&I, hospital meetings, institution meetings. And it didn't buy me freedom, but it bought me relief. And relief ain't so bad till you can get to the point to take the actions that eventually give you the freedom. And I never imagined that a guy like me could ever be free. I came here seeking relief, and I thought the best that I'll ever find here is intermittent relief interspersed with just depression and anxiety. In the book, The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, it talks about untreated alcoholism, and it says that we will, in that state, we only know three emotional conditions: anxiety, excitement, and depression. Either the excitement of maybe getting my own way, or the excitement when you're screwing with me and I get ratcheted up and I'm excited and people are saying, don't be so excited here. Let it go, Bob, let it go. Or the anxiety, the fear that I live in, of the constant worry that you're going to take something from me, or I'm not going to get my way, or things ain't going to be right. And then the depression, when no matter how much effort I put out, life just seems to sink away from me. After all I've done, and it's still blah. It's still like this. I never imagined the freedom that was going to come through step four. What time are we supposed to take the next?
Yeah, we can do it in 5 minutes.
In 5 minutes?
Yeah, we can take it now if you want.
Why don't we take it now? We'll come back and we'll go do step four.